Okay, so here's my talk title and my affiliations. So I have goals for this talk, and unfortunately my screen here is blank, so I have to actually turn around and read this.
If you look in the middle at the back.
I can't see that far. So I want to present something new. I want to make you consider something you hadn't considered before, and I want to facilitate discussion. So when I use this, can the people online see this, or do
it's, I think so.
Or is it better for me to use the pointer? I mean, this is wonderful. It makes me want to beat people.
Yeah,
it's really, really good.
It's a trade-off, you know.
Yeah, I'll try to do both. All right, so here's the questions where you wake up. Okay, when are you at your worst? When you're time crunched and have deadlines, if that's you, please just raise one hand. Are you at your worst? All right. And then when you're hungry, that is me. Yes. When you feel stupid or ignorant. Uh-huh. When you're at a language disadvantage. That's me. Okay. When you made a mistake. Right. And with strangers, do you have social anxiety? Let's start stomping our feet. You have social anxiety. Okay. And then with those you disrespect, right? Or those that make you feel uncomfortable, stomp your feet. A few stomps. When you're sleepy and jet lag, oh, yes, yes, yes. When you're drunk and intoxicated, just say no, right? Just say no. When you're overwhelmed, oh, yeah, yep. And with those that disrespect you, that's me. I get so furious. So what can you do? When you're at your worst, please do the world a favor and set your boundaries for their protection, right? So you may have to use phrases like this. I will need to eat about that time because, you know, when I'm hungry, I'm evil. I need the next 30 minutes to think. I have hidden in the bathroom when I'm being horrible. It's like, okay, let me go take a time out, go and hide in the bathroom for a while. But please take the time to set these boundaries. Don't be mean. You know, you're at your worst. You know that you're escalating. Then just take a chill pill and do us all a favor. Now, in contrast, when are you the most generous with your time and expertise? And this one, who wants to tell me? I'll start at the middle. Is it Bob?
Rob.
Mm-hmm. Can you answer this question, please?
I'm usually not asked this question.
Mm-hmm. Something new.
Probably when I perceive the person really needs my help. And sometimes I regard it as a pain in the you-know-where, but it usually often with a student, I need a letter of reference by tomorrow, something like that. I would probably, doesn't mean I would be a generous or cheerful giver, but I would probably say statistically that's the case.
Okay. Anyone else want to share? Ruth?
Okay. When I feel relaxed.
Is that very often?
Yeah.
Okay, in the back.
When I have to do academic service for which I don't know if I can say no.
And that's being generous. But you feel like you're over a barrel. I mean, don't you have some resentment about being forced to do academic service that you can't say no to?
Okay, no, because you say that the generous part is also something I tend. Maybe there is also a part of me that just do it for giving.
Right. Yeah. I'm the worst for academic service. When I'm asked to do academic service that I don't want to do, I say, okay, so if I do that, then I can't finish this grant proposal and I can't mentor my graduate students. And so what are you going to do for me if I take on this service? And they're like, shut up, Jarita. And they ask somebody else. So not generous at all. All right, here's our first film clip. We have three.
I wore kind of very baggy, you know, very baggy shirt and all this. However, the department chair could tell. I remember he would not stop talking about like maternity leave policies and all this stuff. Like, I haven't said anything about having a kid. And he even said, I have a feeling this information might be useful to you. Okay, thanks, didn't say anything. Because a colleague of mine had told the NRIO guy who was in charge of the hiring committee who had told him. So I don't know if he could tell like by looking at me, but someone had told him.
When I came, I was the third PhD astronomer hired. So Ann Kinney was the first, Meg Urey was the second, and I was the third. Meg and I always laugh because when I was giving my job interview, I can't remember, we were both pregnant, right? So she introduced me and I gave my, you know, whatever, 7 months pregnant job interview. So it was kind of a critical moment in women at Space Telescope.
In an academic career, you know, you're in these sort of temporary contracts. And so you never know, you know, next year, am I still going to have a job? Am I still going to have health insurance? So sort of the planning of when do I want to start a family is extremely difficult. One female postdoc got pregnant near the end of my time. And, you know, people were generally supportive, but were like, oh, no, like, how is this going to impact your career? Are you going to be able to keep up with the project? And so I think a lot of people delay starting a family until they have a permanent position. And that can be really difficult.
And basically in Sweden, right, you can't put your child in daycare until they're a year because the government is paying you to stay home with the kid. Unfortunately, the government was not paying us to stay home with the kid because it doesn't really work if you move into the country, like when your kid has just been born, because they don't know how much money you made before. So they're like, we can't really like pay you. So we didn't actually get to use those benefits, but he was staying home with the kid for the whole year. And we moved when the kid was 6 months, I think.
Just living in Sweden for more than a year guarantees you the Swedish healthcare system. Certainly the social benefits here are great. Like, someday I'd like to have kids, and, you know, having a year and a half off when you have a kid as you know, a nominal father is sort of, you know, that's pretty great.
At that time, the first 1 year, you got 90% of your salary. So it's sort of a company that is contributing to this social funding kept by the state. After 1 year, the company is not paying you anymore. It's state that is fully paying you. So obviously it's not a great amount of money. You can't live with that easily, but we were staying with my parents, so it was sort of okay, we could have survived. And these remaining 2 years, it's really fully the state that is paying you. And the company where you were working previously is just engaged to keep, to be ready that after those 3 years you can come back and they should employ you back.
The fact that I am being a role model for women, Latin American women, for women who want to be mothers and want to be astronomers. As I told you before, I came back to work. For example, after 6 months, even though the maternity leave could be longer, and I always was worried that people will think that you need to be like that in order to be in academia, like you need to cut your maternity leave. I want to be welcome to the people who want to have 1 year maternity leave. I just want to say that it was one of the topics I talked with my coach, and it helped me also to navigate that feeling of not feeling guilty by following what works for me while still trying to be a good role model. So she helped me to do that.
Okay, so we have the advantage of being a distributed collaboration that's international. But where is the best place in our collaborations to have babies? Do you know? So the people who spoke on my film clip were in Sweden, where if you've lived in Sweden for a year, then when you have a kid, the government pays you for a year and they hold your position and you don't lose any years of your postdoc, or if you're on a postdoc, if it's a 3-year postdoc, you're still gonna have 3 years with a one-year hiatus. Okay, in Slovakia, it's 3 years paid leave, and your help and your job is held for you. In the University of Arizona, where I was a junior faculty, we had temporary reassignment of duties for a year after giving birth, which meant no classroom teaching for a year or longer if you need it, but still I mentored students and did research and other negotiated tasks. So does anyone have any comments where they think in this collaboration the best maternity leave policies are? I have no idea what the maternity leave policies are here in Canada, for example. You're smiling like that. You're smiling like they suck here.
No, they don't suck. Okay. Oh, they're okay. I don't know. It depends, right? Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I can give you some of it. Like some of the loopholes, for example, is if you are on contract, it depends on where you're working. If you are, for example, on a contract with university, you have to have, if, you know, so there's a government payment, which is if you have had enough hours of working in the previous year, you can qualify it. But given that you cannot necessarily time your contract, my first pregnancy happened as soon as my contract with Premier ended. And then the number of hours didn't count, so I didn't get any maternity leave from university. The second time with university, it was you have to have 6 months prior to the end of your contract in order to qualify for any top-up. Otherwise, you just get the minimum. So there are so many other aspects of it that I can the other thing is, for example, technically, both father and mother can take the paternal or maternal leave, but then you take into account the wage gap between women and men. So that for family, it doesn't make sense for the father to take the paternal. So it's again the women who have to.
So what's the, when you're on paternity leave, how much are you paid?
What do you mean?
So that means just leave, no pay?
No, you, government pays you some to some maximum.
Yeah.
Per week, depending on what your payment has been when you were working to whatever position. So that's usually, there's, I don't remember what the maximum is. Mm-hmm. But
it's not your full salary.
It's not. It's okay. 60% up to a maximum or something.
It's usually the federal government pays a certain amount, and then your employer usually tops it up.
Yeah, and the employer does, but the employer's not obliged, technically, right? Mm-hmm. And this is all new. I mean, 10 years ago, it wasn't in place at all.
Wow. All right, moving along. All right. So social science research has shown that diverse teams win. However, the diverse members must be well integrated to bring those benefits. So what does that term well integrated mean? It means that they're listened to, they're given space to talk, their ideas are welcomed, they can argue without being penalized or reprimanded, and they feel valued. Has anyone seen the Air Jordan movie yet? What? You guys live in a cave? Wow. You do. The Air Jordan movie.
We're all too busy doing physics.
No, it's in the movie theaters. So it's, you know, it's a male environment. You know, they're all doing sneakers and, you know, athletic shoes, etc. And they're continuously insulting each other, you know, walking out on each other, and they have absolutely no fear of being fired, right? And I was like, wow, is that what it's like? You know, okay. So they were well integrated, and they all felt like they had a role and that they were valued, therefore they could misbehave. So the misbehaving is not so good, but the security and knowing that they were valued was that well integrated part of it. Okay, here's another short film on precarity. So let's get that one going.
So when you move for a postdoctoral position, it's kind of like you have to grow up. People look up to you. It's a lot more pressure. You're in short-term contracts. You have to constantly think about funding. And PhD students that you meet are don't sort of relate to you as much as they relate to their fellow PhD students. You know, and those other postdocs who may be in the same position as me are often already people that have families that also have children. And so I found it that not only was it difficult for me to find my place in Switzerland as a foreigner, it was also difficult for me to find my place in that university community because I'm used to a fun group of young, fun-having individuals, and I was suddenly in this place in this kind of like, oh, I'm a postdoctoral fellow now, and I'm supposed to be more serious, and I'm supposed to, you know, work really hard. Somehow I think that was a tricky part for me to find myself. And I think a lot of PhD, a lot of postdoctoral fellows struggle with that. Almost everybody who I know who have switched places from their PhD to postdoc struggle from a social perspective.
Now, it used to be that you could get something called from the Swedish Research Council called a VR Start Grant, which was supposed to get you a similar to the ERC Start Grant. But these days, if you get one, they just say, okay, great, we'll give you an office. They don't give you a tenure track position. They just allow you to, you know, employ yourself with your grant money on their premise until such time as it runs out. I don't want to be in this like carrot stick situation for, you know, until I'm in my mid-40s, where I don't know if I'm going to be allowed to stay, etc. Imagine making a stepping stone towards the ERC, or you could imagine, you know, I talked to one faculty member who, you know, being white male and famous himself, just assumes that one can sort of do the thing where you're like, oh, you do good enough work, maybe you can convince your famous advisor to put in a good word for you with, and then maybe somebody opens a position and it could happen. But it's one of those things where just nothing's guaranteed and everything's predicated on presumably high research output being maintained indefinitely until they see fit to offer you a position. And it just doesn't seem like a... it doesn't seem reasonable.
This is one aspect that is maybe not... people. I think people don't realize this aspect, that the life of a postdoctoral researcher, it's really tough, not only because all the things that you have this uncertainty of having non-permanent position, you have to perform at your top level almost all the time. Like I feel the enormous pressure in the sense that if I'm invited to go somewhere and to give a talk, I feel like I'm not allowed to refuse, right? Because it's my future that is in play, right? But at the same time, I have kids, and sometimes I need to negotiate my personal life. And if I were permanent, I would ease on much more things, right? I wouldn't accept every offer for every kind of possible things, like being referee here, being referee there, part of this project, that project. So, and this kind of like, how much does it cost for one postdoc or eventually one family to move from one place to another? I think this has never been discussed, and it's really an important burden on the entire family and on the budget, and I can totally confirm that. So I was lucky enough that I had some personal money, but why should I spend my personal money on my professional career, right? It's just that these institutions, they are not used to the fact that they are not used to think about you before you become their employer, right?
The university doesn't, you know, they have certain ideas about different jobs. So they, you know, they have the academic jobs, they have technical jobs, they have, and I'm fit somewhere in between. So I started off at grade 7 when I started a job, and going up to grade 8 was quite difficult for lots of people in my team. I was, I think, the first one at my level to do that. It was a difficult arguing case. In fact, a few years later, it was funny, when I was selling my first house, my first flat, one of the people who looked at it turned out to be someone who worked in another department in the university. She mentioned that she had been on the board, which had looked at our promotions, and said, oh yes, you're that strange wide field unit. We never knew what you guys really did, and I got the feeling that I never really bothered to check either. It took two or three attempts to get this promotion. other my colleagues have struggled a lot more than me to do that, and you do feel a bit undervalued sometimes. You feel you're doing important work, but it's not always recognised that way. But I did wonder if I should just go off somewhere else. You know, should I either apply for other jobs in astronomy or go off into the private sector? Vet's got some reasonably good software skills, which you've been processing projects, which could be useful outside. There'd be other times when you've got redundancy letters and you're thinking, you know, is it really worth this? Is it worth the stress that puts you under?
So what can our collaboration do about job precarity? And while you're thinking about that, let me put my mic back on. Who do we care about? Who do we think it is fine to lose to industry and to non-research jobs? Can we offer longer postdoc positions? Can we give postdocs manageable short-term projects so that they can produce several articles per year? Can we secure extra funds for bridging career gaps to retain talent and offer these to women too? So I found with my research that these bridging funds were mainly offered to white men and not to women or anyone else. And are there any other ideas of what we can do in our collaboration about job precarity?
Yeah, I mean, so the starting point question is what fraction of, let's say, graduates that go into at least one postdoc job end up being professional researchers in academia as opposed to private sector? I'm just wondering what proportion we're even talking about.
We're talking about your collaboration. We're not going to put it in the larger context. We're going to focus on this room, this collaboration.
Well, why? It seems like it,
because when you start putting it in the context of larger things, it's kind of passing the buck, right? And I usually have a rule that if I think that you're passing the buck, you owe me $20, right? So just focus on the things you have control of and don't worry about the larger issues, right? So you have control of the people in this room, the people in your collaboration, the people who are your graduate students. So tell me, what are your statistics about how many of your students have gone on to become professional?
I just think that's a completely myopic viewpoint on the problem.
I mean, why is it a problem for students to go into industry or
yep.
private sector? You know, I mean, that is, in the UK, student funding is explicitly to try and increase the knowledge economy and to send students into industrial, but they are also research jobs. Just going out of academia doesn't mean you're not doing research.
Right.
So I think that first question, I'm not sure I see necessarily the problem. It's extremely, you know, saying, oh, you can only do an academic career, I think is very missing the point about what we can do for society. So, you know.
You wanted to comment?
So to basically follow up on Ruth, so when I take on students, I basically ask them, are you interested in a teaching yeah. career or are you interested in a business career?
Yeah.
I don't even say that's a pure research career, because I think this is too risky. And when I started studying, it was absolutely clear to me that I was going to go to a teaching career.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll sympathize with that.
Back corner?
I think it's fair, and I mean, I think a lot of our students these age, they actually do love the industry, and that's perfectly okay. So everybody's for the whatever job they like, that's fine. I think the issue I have is the disproportional losing of certain groups. Like at BTL, oh, we want to like encourage women to come to undergrad or like at high school. But the pattern is bad. It's not that we're losing 80% of the students to industry. That's fine, yeah, because we don't have capacity in academia. What I don't like, or I don't think, is the how the ratio changes as we go to higher and higher top of the ladder.
Yeah.
That's the issue, right? Is it that all the women are not interested and like to go to industry, and the white men are interested and stay in academia? That's
question.
Yes. Why do you, these were questions that 20 years ago,
yes,
we found your work close on our mind. We discussed these for hours, many hours and many days and weeks, and we do offer longer postdoc positions. The fact that we offer 5-year postdoc positions is entirely because of our concern about the autonomy and the quality of the work for postdocs, et cetera. So we have thought a great deal about these questions, and we have done a great deal to give postdocs more autonomy, more individuality, et cetera, so that they can do really great work and go on to great jobs.
Okay. Thank you, disembodied voice.
My Leah Smalley, by the way, I think he's going to join us later, maybe in the meeting.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else online who wants to add? And then there was one person back here, and then you. Okay.
Concerning the fact that it's not a problem that people go to industry. I think the question is rather what kind of people are we selecting to do science? I mean, people can do whatever they want. What we have to think about is whether the system is selecting actually the best people to do science, or is selecting people based on other kind of qualities that may not be the best ones. This is probably a selfish point of view from the point of view of science, so we want the right people to do science. We don't want only the ones who manage to survive long enough, right?
Mm.
So,
John?
Just a comment that I read in an article that postdoctors only 5% succeed in getting an academic faculty position. Is that correct? That's what I read.
Sorry, what was the statistic?
5%. Okay. All right, moving on. So interdisciplinary research costs more, takes longer, it's harder to become a cohesive team, so you may have to do team building, and it's harder to manage given the different academic language conventions. So similarly,
sorry to interrupt you. I think it might not be obvious for everybody in this room, but this is a team building exercise that we, if you hadn't noticed that, you are being indoctrinated, so. Okay, just wanted to know.
Right, so, but I'm not coming to any conclusions. I'm letting you guys talk, right? So in parallel, diverse scientists, meaning indigenous, disabled, minority scientists, may need more time. May need additional financial resources. They need to feel welcomed and not just tolerated. They may be overworked doing outreach and community duties like you in the back. They may not know the unspoken rules, so are at a cultural disadvantage. They may suffer from culture shock, homesickness, loneliness, and this may manifest in mental illness. And they may need much, 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 much more mentoring, which we should offer. And they're more likely to be fired and let go, right? So I'm curious what my next slide is after saying that. Oh, there's a film clip, okay. Did you want to comment on that before we get to the film clip? I mean, they're just kind of social science facts.
Yes. This is going to push against people that want to advance their own careers. What is their incentive to do this beyond the goodness of their hearts?
But
that's the biggest problem I see this running into.
Well, even if they do love it, I mean, and I always wondered why, you know, women, when you, I don't know, have you been to like women in science things? And okay, they always go, well, you have to love it. And it's the rest of the sentences, because they're going to drag you through the mud and beat you up, and you're going to be not listened to, and you're going to be treated badly. You know, it's the subtext of the rest of the sentence, right? So you're going to be abused and all that stuff. So you better love it, right? But because of all that, all those horrible things that happen to you, even if you love it, it's not enough, right? It's not enough. You have to feel valued. You have to feel like you have a future. You have to like the people that you're working with. You have to trust the people that you're working with.
But I'm speaking from the viewpoint of people that would be doing the mentoring, of people that would be finding the resources.
Yeah.
And I mean, I remember entering as a graduate student, people telling me, I don't care how much of an SOB so-and-so is, if they do great physics, that's all that matters. Now, I think we've come a long way since then, but I think what this still pushes up against is the people that do the mentoring, what's in it for them to mentor people that are going to take a lot more of their time and energy. This is human nature, and you can tell.
No, that's an efficiency. It's an efficiency argument. It's an efficiency argument.
Okay.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, I sort of disagree that we've come a long way. I'd just like to mention a personal experience I've had at a very elite US schools. So there's an African-American student who came up with a great idea. I knew about that. A couple of months later, a paper appeared by faculty at this elite school. He was not included.
When was that, Robert?
This could happen today.
Mm-hmm.
At the same school.
Yeah.
You think it would still happen?
It would still happen today.
Okay.
It would happen even worse today.
All right. I'm going to get Ruth. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that.
So I think everything you've written there resonates, but I think that it's quite possible to deal with at least some of these issues, particularly referring to resource, if you have a system that properly recognizes resource, such as committee duties being grouped in with teaching and all sort of part of a workload allocation. So it's not that there's no solution, but I think what your list emphasizes is that you have to take a very comprehensive view of the contributions that people are making so that you can acknowledge all these extra things that people do.
Okay, I'm going to move on to our last film clip, which is on discrimination.
Sexism would definitely direct her towards me, and then and certainly from, because of that, where a lot of the grad students would come and talk to me and tell me things that were happening. Just informally, I kind of became the auntie, the stern but caring auntie, and I was and even when they would try to connect, let the department head know, in the same way that I, in my run-ins, had tried to go up the chain, they were, nothing ever really came of any of the complaints. And I remember at some point just wondering why this was allowed. Like, why, how is this acceptable when there's clearly people who are guilty of academic bullying and continue to be allowed to do so by a department? And the response is, well, that's just the way that person's always been, and you shouldn't take him seriously. And I'm just like, well, I may be okay with surviving this, but what kind of climate do you think that's, contributing to for our younger people, for the grad students, for the undergrads? What kind of example do you think that's giving all the people who are coming through and being trained in our program that they can act like this and it's acceptable?
I often feel like I don't understand what's happening around me, like certain types of interactions or certain types of unwritten things happen in academia that are maybe mostly like competitive or people who are sometimes like people sometimes choose not to be helpful on purpose. But it just is really confusing to me, because if I can be helpful, I will be helpful. And so like when certain things happen in academia like this, I find it very confusing.
And it also turned out that the research group environment was pretty toxic. As toxic a work environment as I've ever been in. Like, people just yelling at each other in meetings, and like actually yelling in each other's faces. The women in that group were especially miserable, and they were made partially miserable by the fact that the group was large enough and the advisor hands-off enough that there was a power vacuum filled by male postdocs who were generally bad actors. And they were bad actors in different ways. They were the well-intentioned but very loud German, you know, men who would just shout over everybody by a matter of default, and then there were actual neo-Nazis. Like, you know, for example, I'm having beers with this guy, and, yeah, get ready for depressing science stories, but I'm having beers with this guy, and he's, you know, just drinking. He's a Greek guy. And he starts talking, like, at some point he's like, oh, yeah, this, that, and the other, and then he says, like, yeah, Mussolini was right about this, that, or the other. I'm like, what? And then, like, another colleague starts coming down as a Jewish descendant. He's like, ah, here comes the Jew. Like, you know. But I start talking to, like, some other people about him and talking to one of the women in the group. And she's like, oh, yeah, he's real bad. Like, he basically, like, took over my PhD project and then bullied me until I quit it and got a new project. And, like, I, you know, reported everything every step of the way. But the advisor is basically like, ah, everybody needs to sort out their own, you know, stuff.
And then when I was at Space Telescope, and I was, you know, had made it a little higher up in the echelons, and so maybe I was full professor equivalent then or whatever. So I was on various committees to evaluate other people, and then we would get external letters on the folks. And then these letters would come in, which would, you know, KO this person. If you didn't know that that person was bad because this person had disproved their theory or something, then you could, they were undefensible, and they would be, you know, that would be the end of them, right? They would be, so that I learned, I was surprised, again, I'm stupid, that, you know, there was a lot of this personal animosity that developed and these hierarchies, and again, I have this naive view of science and everybody seeking the truth and all of this stuff. And so that part I really don't like.
A colleague of mine, and so she was a female researcher, and she realized this. And again, I mean, it was too late, right? But she realized that the male researcher with the same experience as herself, almost in the same group, they had different salary, which I found really shocking. Because if they allow someone to negotiate, they should, in my opinion, distribute the money that is left to so that everyone with the same experience has the same salary. I mean, this is for me, I can't understand why would you let someone do differences or make differences in the salary at this stage.
All right, so as a group, how do we stay aware of harassment, bullying, and discrimination in our collaboration?
So I think the way is just to have an open door, and I guess we should appear approachable by more junior people in a collaboration in the department, in the group. And maybe just have enough people who have an open door policy, enough people who, the junior people are free or have, they think they can share things with them. Something is going wrong.
Yeah.
Follow up to what Nia Yesh said, but the key to this is empathy. And unfortunately, empathy takes a lot of emotional labor. So empathy means that you feel, you put yourself in the shoes of the other person, and you suffer. And this is something that very often people don't want to do, because it's hard to take on yourself this kind of pain. You take on yourself the pain of the other. You share the pain of the other. So I think because it's only in the moment in which you share the pain that you understand what the other people is going through, and you can try to help, and you wish to help. So I think it's that the point here is we all say we want to do that. We all say we have the wish for a better society, but we have to be ready to take the burden on us.
Okay, Ruth.
Don't make excuses, listen, and actually take action if you think it's necessary. But absolutely don't make excuses. Call it out.
May I say something?
Oh.
Yes, disembodied voice.
I'm surprised to hear this conversation without mentioning the thing that the perimeter training points to over and over again, which is report. What the perimeter documents say on this question is you have to report what somebody tells you, whatever you think the consequences of that will be. And I'd be interested to hear that debated, if that's actually what the rule is here. It's got nothing to do with empathy or so forth. If somebody comes to you and says that they're being harassed or bullied or discriminated against, you are to report them to the cultural and people people.
So that's how it is in the US as well. It's a federal offense, so you're supposed to hand them forms to fill out, and it gets handled by the government. It's not a department issue. So you first, and then.
Well, I was going to say, I'd put a positive spin on it. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Treat other people the way you wish you were treated yourself. And I think that'd be more positive. I mean, if you see something really bad, sure, report it, but I'm a bit concerned that we're always looking out to see who's the worst harasser than who, right? Wouldn't that be better to be more positive toward one another? A bit like the empathy thing we heard.
Okay.
Being aware is one thing. Doing something is a different thing. It's much more subtle, at least in Canadian universities and institutions. I know, even globally, you know, it will have reporting might have consequences for that person. So you have to give them the agency, tell them about the options, legal options that you are aware of, or refer them to the places that can do it. But I would never take it on myself to take an action without knowing what consequences that would imply for that person.
Was that a hand? No. Am I out of time?
5 minutes.
5 more minutes, okay. Back corner.
I'm confused. I'm truly confused. Maybe I am very blind. I know I'm blind in many things. Maybe I'm lucky. Maybe I just am screened by something, by what happened in my own life in the particular. But I've been in three universities in Italy as a student, as a postdoc. I've been in 10 years in the US as a faculty at various levels. I've been 20 years in France leading a group, then in some confused position like I am now. And I've seen people with difficulty, students crying because whatever, and all sort of. But the impression, the picture I've got from this, and I generally say maybe I'm just blind, is that I've seen very little competition, very little bullying, very little of all this. Most I've seen wonderful people helping one another, collaborating, nice places where I've seen old faculties fighting with one another like dogs. Yes.
Count yourself lucky.
Wasn't blind.
Just count yourself lucky.
Maybe it's just lucky.
I essentially have exactly the same feeling. I mean, I recognize as a white male, I'm privileged in a lot of ways, but I have the same feeling as, like, throughout my entire academic career, the kind of stuff that they're talking about in this thing, not once have I ever experienced anyone having this sort of problems.
Count yourself lucky as well. Yes.
So, I was just going to say, my wife is also an academic. She also has a box of tissues that she always has in her office. She has people coming in to talk to her and crying all the time because she's seen as the person who can do this kind of emotional labor.
Yep.
I'm not. So I've had, I think, one student cry in my office once. Like, I just, so I realize that there's a
different worlds.
A different, mm-hmm. Yeah, because of the sort of the way people interact with me is just completely different than her.
So there's that selection bias, basically.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Back corner, and then Ruth. Yeah.
Yes, you're blind, Carlo. No, the problem is that, I mean, if you're a white person, you attract around you like-minded people. But this is not the experience that everybody has. And of course, people that have somehow the courage to come to your group are already in a better position, but there is the rest of the world and people that are driven out of academia because of bad experience with their advisor and so on. So.
Okay.
Just very quickly, if people are yelling at each other in a meeting, that is a problem, first of all. And secondly, so I'm a head of department in the UK, and the couple of weeks running up to Christmas, I had to send 3 emails to staff to say your behavior was unacceptable. So, you know, sorry, it goes on all the time. These are not egregious offenses. This is just where someone's got tired, they've snapped, but what they've done has really upset someone or intimidated someone. And you have to just point out, it's not actually acceptable. Just apologize and it'll all be fine. And sure enough, it was all fine. And we're not saying that this is a mass, it's not resolvable in a simple way, but I think we do have to call out even small things. You know, maybe not calling them harassment is even strong, but, you know, if you are in a position of power over someone else and you take out your annoyance over some particular thing on them, then that is actually already throwing things out of balance.
Right, because they're vulnerable.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so I must say I've seen instances of this kind of bullying basically everywhere I've been, including when I was a visitor at the Permanent Institute.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying that.
If I can just,
yes.
One thing following up from what Ruth was saying is the kind of emotional labor I was talking about is exactly the exhausting one that is related to the small things. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, if there is a rape, we all agree about something, about
yeah.
what is going on, and there is a clear solution. There is the justice to take care of this. But it's about all the microaggression, and very often these microaggression, they are not even recognized by the person who is receiving them. It's you that you make yourself vulnerable, and so you recognize the behavior that, and you call it out. And this takes an effort. It takes pain, it takes courage, and it takes time because you have to talk. You
yeah.
have even to talk with the person who is the victim of it to explain
yeah.
what's going on to them.
Yeah. And it's all, you know, it's all mental and emotional labor taking you away from what you're supposed to be doing, physics. All right, so that's it. Thank you for your responses and participating. And hopefully you will think about this as we move forward in this collaboration.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.